top stories, Iran says the U.S. government bears ultimate international responsibility for the 2020 assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Israeli forces kill yet another Palestinian near a settlement in the West Bank amid heightened tensions in the occupied territory. Also ahead, the U.S. hits record daily COVID cases led by the Omicron variant amid warnings of a, quote, viral blizzard of infections next month. Iran says the U.S. bears ultimate international responsibility for the 2020 assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. Tehran says the Criminal and Terrorist Act will not go unpunished and pledges to continue efforts to bring to justice the perpetrators. Iran says the assassination of the lieutenant general sent a message of support to terror groups and exposed U.S. lies that it fights terrorism worldwide. Iran says Soleimani was an anti-terror hero who helped promote peace and stability in the region and elsewhere in the world. January the 3rd marks the anniversary of the assassination of the top Iranian general. Soleimani, along with senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were killed in a U.S. drone attack near Baghdad. Earlier I spoke to human rights activist Firas al-Najim. He says the U.S. supports terrorism or terrorist groups because they help it control the region and secure its allies, including Israel.
He worked on a big project of destroying ISIS, this big terrorist, network that was disrupting, the Middle East, and also was destabilizing all of Iraq, and was a danger to, Iraq from every corner. And he helped dismantle and destroy this terrorist organization. And right after he finished and he was successful and completed this project, USA comes inside and kills this man and his partner as well, and ally Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, these both great generals that saved the world. They worked for world peace, not just Iraq or for Iran. And this shows clearly that the U.S. is behind the terrorism, and they're also the supporters of terrorism, and that they want more terrorism in the region, because this was what really it helps their benefit and interest in controlling the region and securing their allies and securing Israel. And that's the main reason why they support these terrorist groups. They don't have to publicly say that they support these groups, but by this act of killing Qasem Soleimani,
Israeli forces have shot dead a Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank. Israeli media citing the military have accused the Palestinian of trying to carry out a stabbing attack. We were earlier joined by our correspondent in Ramallah for more details on the story. Take a listen.
According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, 36-year-old Amir Khadr Rayan from the village of Karawa, Bani Hassan, northern the occupied West Bank, was shot by the Israeli forces at the Haris junction that leads to Nablus and Salfit, and also it leads to the entrance of the illegal settlement of Ariel. The Israeli forces, immediately as they saw this Palestinian man, they opened fire and they shot him in the abdomen. Later, the Israeli military revealed that the man succumbed to his injuries. None of the Israeli soldiers were wounded. None of the Israeli settlers also were wounded. But the Israeli military insisted on it was an attempt to stab the Israeli soldiers standing at the junction there.
Palestinian journalists are raising the alarm over what they describe as unjust suppression of their content on social media giant Facebook. Journalists have cited several incidents to back their claim. One of them says Facebook has deleted his video showing Israeli forces shooting dead a Palestinian on the ground. An online Palestinian outlet says Facebook has deleted its page with 1.2 million followers. In 2021 alone, Facebook restricted or deleted 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian posts. That's according to a Palestinian social media monitoring center. Meanwhile, international rights organizations have previously spoken out against Facebook for suppressing content about Israeli rights violations. Social platform's parent company, Meta, rejects the accusations. Meta says it's only trying to keep Facebook safe by removing harmful content. Political commentator Dawood Kotob says Facebook has a long history of removing content depicting Israel's hostility towards Palestinians under the pretext of violent censorship.
The social media giant Facebook or Meta has been mixing things between anti-Semitism and anti-Israelism. So they have often blocked or canceled or deleted accounts that were strongly against the Israeli occupation under the guise that these are anti-Semitic sites, which is not true, and under the guise that these are inciting to violence, which is also not true. So yes, I would definitely agree that the unelected censors at Facebook have acted in a way that is not neutral. I mean, if they want it to be safe, they need to also show that it's safe also from the Israeli side. So it has to be done on an equitable basis, and it has to be done by neutral individuals, not by people who already have a vested position on the Palestine-Israel conflict. I don't think that is is a correct answer. I think it's a justification to excuse their bias towards the Palestinians.
At least three members of the Saudi death squad that murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi in October of 2019 are not spending their time in jail, but in luxury villas in Riyadh. That has been revealed by leading British daily The Guardian, citing a Saudi intelligence source. The three assailants are said to be living in seven-star accommodation inside a government-run security compound. Two witnesses visiting the facility several times in the past 2 years have told the source that they have seen the three men. The same source said the men include Salah Ad-Tabaigi. He is the forensic scientist who dismembered Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Tabaigi and the two other men have already been convicted on Khashoggi's killing before a Saudi court. The trial, however, was widely criticized as a sham. And now the latest report casts further doubt on Saudi claims that justice has been served. U.S. intelligence agencies have said Khashoggi was murdered by order of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, that is. On that story, I'm going to bring in John White. He is a writer and political analyst who joins us via Skype out of Edinburgh. Many, many thanks, John White, for joining us. Tell me what you think about this. I mean, Guardian publishing this, and, you know, you cannot say 100% is right, but it's a credible thing. If we take this to be right, then what kind of reaction do you have to it?
Well, thanks for having me. Given the character of this regime, and in particular the cutthroat, and he is a cutthroat, Mohammed bin Salman, who sits at the apex of this regime in Riyadh, this is absolutely no surprise. This was murder most foul against the Saudi dissident journalist. He was also a US resident, which you would think of, would have afforded him some protection. And the cover-up that followed was with the compliance of Western governments, who offered only the most tepid criticisms and sanctions against bin Salman for the murder of Mr. Khashoggi. And so what we have is an indictment of Western foreign policy in terms of the relationship with the Saudis, which is less, Saudi Arabia is less a state and more a family business, whose business is murder. So these revelations come as absolutely no surprise. The men who were involved in this murder are very close to bin Salman, part of his inner coterie of thugs and cutthroats. And indeed, they're being rewarded for services to Mr. bin Salman. The man's a cutthroat, it cannot be stressed enough. And this is less a country underpinned by laws and more a family business underpinned by the rule of the knife.
What can be done about this, John White? I mean, even if it's a revelation by
by The Guardian. Don't you think perhaps more publications should come out, or you know, this needs to be taken into another level? You know, what is the best course of action for those concerned with this revelation to come out and speak and perhaps, you know, take it to some kind of, you know, credible conclusion?
Well, I mean, citizens in the West, in the UK, where the story appeared in the Guardian newspaper, as you point out, they can also get in touch with their MPs to lodge complaints, to lodge their concerns about this revelation. But, you know, because of the nature of the relationship between the Saudis and Western governments, which is long-standing and is based on geostrategic interests of those Western governments, which is detrimental to the welfare of the people, because Saudi Arabia is the nexus of radical Islam, and the ideology that underpins Saudi Arabia, Wahhabism, is indistinct from the ideology which underpinned the Islamic State or ISIS. So it's, you know, we're giving fuel to this radicalism, but on the one hand, and on the other, claiming to be fighting it. And we're only creating a rod for our own back. We're sowing dragon's teeth. This relationship is not in the interest of the British people or the American people or the French people, but it's certainly in the interest of the arms industries which profit from this sordid relationship and always have done.
John White, writer and political analyst out of Edinburgh, many, many thanks.
Thank you.
Major Muslim American advocacy group in the U.S. reveals two spying incidents against the Muslim community earlier this month, with the cases uncovered within days. The Council on American Islamic Relations says one incident involved the head of its Ohio branch. The council, known as CARE, says it sacked the man on December the 15th after finding that he had passed confidential information to an anti-Muslim group. Same group was again named a week later. That's when an individual volunteering at a mosque told the council that he had been paid to provide information on the Muslim community. CARE believes that the spying is aimed at creating fear and distrust among Muslims in the U.S. The council says it'll step up efforts to battle Islamophobia. Apart from spying, Muslim Americans in the past two decades have been subject to discriminatory policies, including travel bans. Well, 2022 begins on Saturday, but surging COVID cases led by the Omicron variant are clouding the mood in many countries. That includes the U.S., where health experts are warning people to be prepared for a challenging time in January. The country has already seen its daily new infections hit record highs. Based on the 7-day average, 24-hour case counts stood above 290,000 on Thursday. That happened for the second time in a row, or second day in a row. Meantime, a Reuters tally shows at least 18 states have set records for new infections, while overall hospitalizations have increased 27%. The surge comes amid increased holiday travel, with New Year celebrations still to come. That's why American health officials expect a further dramatic rise in infections in January, with some warning of a, quote, viral blitzer. Blizzard, that is. They say people will have a hard time keeping everyday life operating. Well, 2021 was an eventful year for the U.S. and Canada. This report takes a closer look at some of the major occurrences that made headlines in the two biggest countries in the Western Hemisphere.
The United States in 2021.
USA! 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 Chaos broke out very early in 2021 in the United States. Less than a week into the new year, the world was shocked by footage showing thousands of Americans besieging and storming the Capitol building in the heart of Washington, D.C. The reason? They wanted to stop the certification of Joe Biden's victory in the presidential election. Many called it an insurrection. Rarely has the world witnessed with such clarity the inherent division in the U.S. political system. What may previously have been a crack in the country's democracy now turned into a wide chasm. On January 13th, a week after the riots, Donald Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to be impeached twice. The House of Representatives began the trial of the controversial figure after he adamantly refused to concede election defeat and incited his fan to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. However, in yet another sign of the failure of the political duopoly, the Republican-held Senate did not find Trump guilty. Just like the first impeachment proceeding against him on charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. On January 20th, Biden took office. The veteran Democrat, while on the campaign trail, had tried his best to demonize the incumbent leader and distance himself from his policies. But taking his place at the Oval Office, Biden towed Trump's line on multiple fronts. The Biden administration obediently followed its predecessor's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Despite numerous pledges, it refused to stop supporting Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. Biden even blatantly backtracked on his promise to change the U.S. approach towards migrants. People trying to cross into the U.S. faced even more hardship, and those who could get through suffered severe abuse. But that's not all. Getting COVID-19 under control was another pledge that Biden had made. But after almost a year in office, the U.S. remains on top in terms of both infections and death rates. In late December, COVID fatalities reached more than 800,000, but many Americans remained reluctant to get vaccinated as they do not trust their government. During the current administration, rampant gun violence was a major issue for many Americans. Moreover, little has been done to stop global warming, even though the U.S. rejoined the Paris Climate Accord, which Trump had quit. 2021 has not been a good year for civil rights either. Racial equality remains a distant dream for African Americans, despite a long jail term given to Derek Chauvin, a white officer who had violently killed a black man in the previous year. In September, bipartisan negotiations over a police reform bill collapsed. For now, it seems that minorities will still have to live in fear of police brutality.
Canada in 2021.
The United States' northern neighbor, Canada, also experienced a chaotic 2021. In May and June, authorities found nearly 1,200 bodies of Indigenous children buried in unmarked mass graves. The grim discovery refreshed the historical plight of the First Nation Canadians. The children of these communities were forcibly separated from their families during the 19th and 20th centuries and taken to infamous residential church schools where many of them suffered abuse and torture and many others went missing. The scandal rocked Canada's self-proclaimed image of human rights defender. A cultural genocide was what an investigative commission concluded, saying thousands had died and many were subjected to physical and sexual abuse at church-run schools in Canada. In 2021, Canada also saw continued protests calling for justice for thousands of missing or murdered Indigenous women. According to the Native Women's Association of Canada, Indigenous women are three times more likely to experience violence during the course of their life than their non-native counterparts. The damning figure is a clear sign of the deep-rooted colonialism worsened by state inaction. The country also experienced an unprecedented heat wave in the past year, which led to the death of hundreds of people. Wildfires burned for months throughout much of Canada, making it the third worst wildfire season on record. Flooding was another natural disaster that prompted authorities in the Canadian Pacific Coast province of British Columbia to declare a state of emergency in November.
And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
If the truth is not clarified today, the place of the oppressors and the oppressed will be changed. December 12, 2021. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 12, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in meeting with a number of nurses and the families of those martyred while working in the health profession.
Zainab alayhi salam, a lady who had lived with dignity from the time she was born and whom everyone had held in high regard, from her childhood to her adulthood, was insulted by those thugs and ruffians in the Umayyads' army. But she was patient and did not break down. She showed her patience when faced with the huge responsibility of gathering together the orphaned children and the mourning women. This was a great task. She was able to bring together and take care of tens of women and children who were mourning and injured during the difficult journey. These were some of the tasks carried out by Zainab. She showed a great endurance. Indeed, Zainab al-Kubra was an ocean of patience and tranquility.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
She showed that women can reach this point and this great level of inner spiritual strength. In addition to these, she also nursed God's proof on earth, As-Sajjad alayhi as-salam. This also required patience, but she carried out this task in the best possible way. These were some points about her patience. As for her wisdom, intelligent behavior and mental power, her behavior during her captivity was truly amazing. I believe we should study, deliberate on, write and speak about each and every aspect of this behavior. We should produce artistic works about this because this is not a minor issue. She was also a manifestation of resistance and mental strength in the face of those proud, arrogant rulers. When Ibn Ziyad began to address her with remarks in Kufa and said, "Did you see what happened? Did you see that you have failed?" She replied, "I did not see anything but beauty." This was a slap across the face of the arrogant, malicious man, Ibn Ziyad.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Stream.
The date of the withdrawal of U.S. combat occupation forces from Iraq approaches supposedly within days now, Iraqis are still skeptical that the U.S. withdrawal from their country will be a real one. Who's to blame them when the first announced official date of the long goodbye was supposedly August 2021, as per the Trump administration? However, the deadline was simply ignored by the new Biden administration. In July, U.S. President Joe Biden and Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi met in Washington and allegedly agreed to conclude the American combat mission in Iraq by December 31st, 2021. That's 3 days from now. Really? they're just going to simply leave? Well, follow me a little. Let us see how the U.S. operates in Iraq to begin with. It is no secret that the U.S. had adopted a low-cost colonial system of ruling Iraq for almost 10 years now. U.S. warplanes were stationed at up to six former Iraqi air bases, becoming the principal enforcer of the occupation. U.S. troops were thinned out. By 2020, this job was done so skillfully that the U.S. presence in Iraq became almost invisible. Hold on, I said almost. Iraq was occupied by Western forces, but it looked like an independent nation with the U.S. installed president and executive branch. Kurdish areas in the north became virtual U.S.-run mini-states. The demented Daesh movement was totally stamped out by Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi and the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. As a thank you, the Iranian military supremo in Iraq, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps al-Quds forces, was ordered murdered by President Trump. Deputy head of the Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, arose a martyr that day alongside his dear friend and comrade, Martyr Hajj Qasem Soleimani. This grave mistake turned the golden victory in Iraq promised by the American neocons into ashes, leaving Washington stuck deep in an ungovernable nation, yet still capable of defeating Daesh and then targeting its real enemy, the U.S. occupation forces scattered in Iraq. Faced by the threat of more resistance guerrilla warfare, Joe Biden's administration announced it would pull all remaining U.S. combat troops from Iraq, but leaving 2,500 behind for training and embassy security. Training is a bad joke. Iraq has been almost in constant war since 1980. Iraqis need loyalty, pride, and patriotism to be effective fighters. How did I know? Here's a hint. Take a look at how Hashd al-Shaabi operates and you'll realize what the Iraqi army is missing. Who needs training from the armed forces that got whipped in Vietnam and now in Afghanistan? Iraq needs a real national government rather than foreign agents in Baghdad. Which is basically why, my friends, the U.S. will not withdraw from Iraq. It might change the name of its combat forces, but an occupation will always be an occupation, with resistance being its only form of elimination. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. As the date of the withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from Iraq approaches by the end of 2021, Iraqis remain skeptical about whether the withdrawal is real or just on paper. In July, the United States and Iraq held a strategic dialogue session during which the two countries agreed on withdrawing all U.S. combat troops from Iraq by December 31st of this year. Now, Tahsin al-Khafaji, spokesman of the Iraqi Joint Operations Command, had announced last month that most of the combat forces left Iraq and only advisors and those working in the field of intelligence, investigation, and training remained, reiterating that they will leave within 15 days. However, Iraqis fear that there might be no real withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq, neither now after the 15 days have actually passed, nor in the upcoming new year. Rather, as many of the observers believe, there will be only a change in the name of these forces. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Al-Basra in Iraq is Mr. Ali Al-Madhoush, expert in international relations and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Al-Madhoush. It's a pleasure having you on our show. Now, it seems that the question of the century is, will the U.S. really pull out of its of Iraq with its occupation forces by the end of this year, or will it just hang in there and stay? They might chill. They have nothing to lose.
Ya Allah, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. Thank you for hosting me on your show. Of course, as it's well known, especially to those who deal with American approach and behavior. They know that the Americans have great ambitions and intentions announced openly concerning their interests here in Iraq and the region. All this eruption and all this fallout and fragmentation and this great weakness and instability in the region is because none other than the U.S. America has reneged on covenants it had ratified with its own hands. Anyone with just little insight knows very well that if America comes out a door, it re-enters through a wider one and changes colors like a chameleon using painful methods. Undoubtedly, the U.S. cannot leave this region as it views it, as spoils of war par excellence.
Well, Ms. Ali, according to the agreement between Baghdad and Washington, the American forces will keep personnel for, and I quote here, consulting, training, equipment, or equipping, and exchanging intelligence information, I don't know with whom, but that's what they're saying. Now, who's to say that the U.S. won't keep all of its forces, but simply just change their name on paper, or maybe move the combat forces to Syria at a close range from Iraq at all times?
I totally agree with you. It was agreed and approved by Iraqi law and voted on by the Iraqi parliament that no foreign military presence will be allowed in Iraq after December 31, 2021, which is the last legal day for the U.S. presence inside Iraq. However, we know there is a lot of maneuvering and a lot of getting around this decision. In fact, I tell you that there are those inside Iraq who do not want America to leave, unfortunately. The order of the occupation forces to remain is not dependent on America as much as it's dependent on the interests of the certain Iraqi employers of foreign forces. It's humiliating, to be honest with you, how hard they fight to make sure the Americans remain here, crouching on the chest of the Iraqis and the region. There are many measures that America has put in place regarding the neighboring periphery, such as the border with Al-Bukamal and the border with the western region of Iraq. There is also the U.S. Embassy, which contains the largest military base and which America uses advanced defense equipment to protect, as if it wants to stay forever. We agree with you that there is a maneuver that America has prepared for. We are sure that the U.S. forces' exit will only happen on paper, but the truth remains and they cannot change it.
Ms. Ali, Iraqi political groups have called the formation of an alliance to expel American troops from the Arab country, from Iraq, when their mandate finishes by the end of this year, stating that Washington's attempts to prolong the presence of its occupation forces must never be taken into consideration. Do you think that is actually a viable option in case Washington proves to be actually dodging the withdrawal date? Do you think that fighting it out is the option?
It's well known that the Iraqi resistance factions, represented today by the popular mobilization forces, have become deterrent forces against the American entity and the usurping Israeli entity. This resistance has formed an equation of balance of forces. It's the resistance alliance that hurt the Americans and has become a striking tool for restoring rights and limiting the role of the Americans in the region. Today, the Iraqi government and its institutions and the Iraqi regular army undoubtedly have many U.S.-imposed restrictions and many strict measures as they cannot proceed with the process of extracting the Iraqi right. We have harnessed a great experience in fighting the American forces after the U.S. invasion. The U.S. occupation has suffered many hard blows by the Iraqi resistance factions. Undoubtedly, America is determined and waiting for the moment when law, Sharia, custom and humanity justify for us to expel the occupier from our country, especially against an occupation that breaks all laws. So basically, after December 31, Iraq turns into an occupied country, and all occupied countries have the full right to defend their lands and stand in the face of the invaders. May God give more strength to the Iraqi resistance factions. It always does what it vows to do. The U.S. occupation is always on high alert because of the severity of the resistance valor. The awareness of its leaders and its bases that have experienced war for years now, fighting and eliminating Daesh is an example.
Well, Ms. Ali, we know by heart by now how the U.S. operates when it desires to change reality on the ground. Especially in Iraq, we might witness a sharp escalation of chaos, of tensions within the coming weeks as part of efforts to drive U.S. Forces to stay further inside of the country under the pretext of maintaining security inside of Iraq. How do you think the Iraqi resistance forces will react to such a possible scenario?
It is no secret for everyone who follows the American dirty politics that it plays bad roles in its cultural war, its media war, its soft war, its policy of containment, its policy of interfering in internal affairs and imposing its influence by different means and under many pretexts. Today, many countries fall for American lies, such as Saudi Arabia and others, who are deluded into the existence of the illusion of an enemy represented by the Islamic Republic of Iran, in order to create an excuse to sell weapons and maintain their forces and interests in West Asia. Therefore, America will create many crises inside Iraq, but the conscious, the knowledgeable, the people of politics, and those who are aware are following and monitoring this phenomenon. Today, we see that the signs of Americans' embrace of some factions and its sponsorship of some parties have begun to create an unstable and abnormal situation that will place Iraq on a hot plate. Signs of these movements started from the American support for some factions and forces in order to provoke instability that will lead all Iraqi blocs to turn to other external forces to take care of Iraq and get it out of this predicament. Today, the political tensions is evident under the auspices of America and its great intervention by changing the rules of the game. But the resistance forces and factions are conscious and want to miss the U.S. opportunity to invade. Today in Iraq, both wisdom and strength are present to confront America using its own tools.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Al-Madhoush, expert in international relations and political commentator, for joining us from Al-Basra, Iraq. It's a pleasure to have you on our show. And please now stay tuned, because next we will be talking about what options does the Iraqi resistance have to try and push the occupation out of Iraq.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Prior to Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi's visit to the United States, the New York Times described the new agreement to withdraw U.S. forces from Iraq as nothing but a diplomatic play, while Sabreen News, channel affiliated with the Popular Mobilization Forces, criticized the agreement, saying that no American soldier will be withdrawn, their role will only be changed on paper. Why is this agreement seen as a theatrical show? Well, a number of pro-U.S. Iraqi leaders do not want to see the United States completely withdrawing from Iraq. These officials propagate that the U.S. actually supports a stable and friendly Iraq, while asserting every chance they get that a long-term U.S. presence, although maintains American influence in Iraq, however, it will help them mitigate Iranian, Russian, and other forms of what the U.S. refers to as malign influence. Funny how other states that enjoy normal diplomatic non-military ties with Iraq are viewed as maligned by the U.S., while its own forces of occupation is praised as friendship. On second thought, no, it's not funny, it's actually sick. Will the U.S. ever leave Iraq? More in this following report.
Ever since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, it was required of the U.S. occupation to exploit Iraq within a strategy that affects the entire region. However, in recent months, the so-called strategic dialogue between Baghdad and Washington, which set a time frame for the withdrawal of American forces and whose sessions took place under the threats and strikes of the Iraqi resistance led by factions of the Hashd al-Shaabi, gave many indications of how Iraq has turned from an imminent American threat against the axis of resistance in the early post-invasion stages to a threat against the presence of American occupation forces as part of this same axis. And if Iraq's positioning in the U.S. strategy was mainly related to striking the centers of power supporting the resistance movements between Lebanon and occupied Palestine, that is Syria and Iran, while making Iraq the center of an active American presence in the region, then the reality that American policy has reached does not only indicate a failure in that particular goal, but rather exceeds it to a failure within Iraq itself. It was not required to isolate Iraq during the invasion stage from the ongoing state of conflict with the Israeli occupation entity, because it was already outside that conflict. Rather, what was required of Iraq was to be used to isolate and neutralize Syria and Iran, and then attack later on the resistance factions. However, in the years following the invasion, Washington's calculations collided with the transformations witnessed in the Iraqi arena. Iraq itself turned into a popular military and security offshoot for different resistance factions in West Asia, and indeed has become among its deterrent force. In recent months, Iraqi resistance factions affiliated with the popular mobilization Hashd al-Shaabi announced that they had entered the deterrence equation regarding al-Quds, which was announced by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, considering that violating al-Quds equals a regional war. This particular part expresses the transformation inside Iraq, which the United States has always been trying to prevent. This was clearly demonstrated in the report of the Israeli National Security Institute at the end of last year, considering that the Zionist front in any upcoming war will be attacked with thousands of missiles, including dozens of precision missiles and armed drones from several arenas in parallel, from Lebanon, Syria, Western Iraq, and probably Gaza as well. The American military and political presence in Iraq is now threatened by the Hashd al-Shaabi forces, and things could spiral towards a military escalation if the United States tries to circumvent the promises of its withdrawal, at a time when the latter seems unable to enter into an open war. This development was never by chance. Washington was seeking to place Iraq on the map of confronting Syria and Iran, but the resistance axis was aware of the danger of the American scheme leading the axis to embrace Iraqi resistance forces in the post-occupation stage. This kept the American tactic trapped inside the Iraqi arena and transferred it from a strategy of dismantling Syria and Iran outside Iraq to a practical path of dismantling its own military occupation bases inside of it, due to the threats of the Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Stockholm is Mr. Firas Ali, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Firas. Now, the top U.S. commander of the Middle East, his name is General Kenneth Frank McKenzie. He said last week that the United States will keep the current 2,500 troops inside of Iraq for what he said is the foreseeable future. So they're not leaving after all. So why all this propaganda of them leaving when they're not?
Well, I think it's business as usual for the Americans. They're trying to confuse the Iraqi people by conveying different type of information in this regard. Sometimes they say they're going to leave. Sometimes they say we have to make a deal first. And mostly they say we're not going to leave. We're changing the status, the title of the troops in Iraq from combating troops to advisors. But regardless of what they call them, they're only playing with words and counting on time. But no one in Iraq is interested, and especially not the resistance, to play any word feud games with them. They're going to stay. What I think is that the Americans don't have the intention to leave Iraq. They have to be forced out of Iraq because they have invested a lot of money in Iraq, and they've invested and built the biggest embassy in the world in Baghdad, second to the one that's going to come up in Beirut. And they have a military camp in the embassy, the Union 3 camp. So there's a reason for them to resist being forced out from Iraq. But I think this method that they're using by wasting time, counting on time, and trying to confuse people won't work, because they think that people will forget the occupation and go on. But it won't work, because the Iraqi people, especially after the assassination in January last year, have changed, and the tide has changed against the United States of America.
Well, Firas, basically, despite the so-called shift by U.S. forces to a non-combat role in Iraq, they said clearly that they will still provide air support and other military aid for Iraq's fight against Daesh terrorist groups. Now, hold on a second there, because the entire globe already knows who bred, funded, and trained Daesh in Iraq and Syria. And for the love of God, I mean, America killed the two most prominent commanders in West Asia who actually fought and eliminated Daesh. And I'm talking about Martyr Soleimani and Martyr Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. How come the Iraqi population is just okay with this? They continue with their lives when they are being played by the United States of America.
I don't think generally people in Iraq are okay with this. The Iraqi people has a lot of grievances, of course, and the Americans are making them bigger to adjust the time so they can still go on and be have a presence in Iraq. But the title that they're giving to their forces, advisors, that's only a title. The Americans has already acted in Iraq since they came back in 2014 as landlords, and they will continue to do so as long as they are in Iraq. They have not heeded to the agreement they had with the Iraqi government since 2014, and they've acted like they've controlled the Iraqi airspace totally, and they've dealt with the Iraqi resistance forces and Hashd al-Shaabi, which is basically part of the Defense Department Iraq, as terrorists sometimes. And you have the unexpected visit of Trump to Ayn al-Assad, which the Iraqi government didn't know of, and actually in the assassination of the commander of the leaders of the victory leaders, as you mentioned, the Americans used more drones in Iraqi airspace in that operation than what they are allowed to in their deal with the Iraqi government. So no Iraqi accept their presence in Iraq if they don't have any personal benefit. But I would say most Iraqis despise the Americans because they remember that most of their problems from the ascending of the Ba'ath Party was because of U.S. interference in Iraq. They have not forgotten that the United States of America imposed two wars on Iraq. They forced the Iraqi government in eight years war with Iran, and they put sanctions on the Iraqi people that killed more than half a million Iraqi children. The Secretary of State in the United States at that time, Albright, said that this is a price worth to pay, and the Iraqis remember this. And actually, it was the Iraqi people's representatives in the parliament who voted to expel the U.S. troops. So the political situation in Iraq is a mess sometimes, but this vote in the parliament is historic because it shows how big the disapprovement of the U.S. forces in Iraq are.
So basically, the U.S. will try to delay its withdrawal, just as you said, to suggest that it actually has the upper hand in where it goes with its troops, instead of actually being compelled to be kicked out of Iraq and withdraw. But the Iraqi resistance seemingly has a very different plan for the U.S. occupation forces. How do you see the upcoming year in Iraq, knowing that the U.S. has never stood by its declarations and agreements when it comes to any area that it occupies?
The Iraqi resistance have been very clear about the issue. They have given the Americans a deadline, but until the 31st of December this year, New Year's Eve, to leave. And if they don't leave, they will be counted as occupation forces and dealt by that. But remember again that the resistance forces have not been idle since the assassination and the vote in parliament last year. They have notified the Americans from now and then about their presence and which type of resistance they will be forced with if they stay in Iraq. They have attacked a lot of logistical support for the U.S. forces in Iraq. It could sound like small acts, but we have to remember that targeted items are not cheap. It's state-of-art military equipment that costs $100 billion maybe. So the Americans have felt the pain, and it's obvious because the Iraqi government, which Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi leads now, has ordered Iraqi soldiers to go out and patrol those streets that the U.S. logistical support passed by to ensure their safety. But it hasn't been successful. It has been in vain. So the resistance is clever, and they have managed to continue their attacks. One of the resistance forces, Kataib Sayyid al-Shuhada, actually opened the door for volunteers to fight the Americans if they stay after New Year's Eve. And just a couple of days three or four days after they opened the window for that, they have to close it because they got more than 50,000 volunteers who are ready to fight the Americans if they're going to stay in Iraq.
So basically, Iraq is looking at a very tense upcoming new year in the event the Americans remain, but we have faith that the Iraqi resistance has the upper hand in Iraq. And I want to thank you very much, Mr. Firas Ali, for joining us to talk about this issue from Stockholm as a political commentator. Thank you very much for your contribution, and thank you.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, and the host of this program, and our dear guest, like always, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the program again.
Wa alaikum assalam, glad to be here.
And welcome. In these series of programs, Viewpoint, or the Movie Critique Program, we are mainly focusing on the religious concepts rather than the artistic features typical of so-called critical programs about arts and artistic characteristics of the movies. So our main purpose is to address those features and themes which are related about religion and God and whatsoever that goes with that territory. Well, last session we started criticizing the movie 90 Minutes in Heaven, and today, inshallah, we're going to continue our critique of the movie. Before that, let's take a short break and listen to a part of the movie, and then we'll be back criticizing the movie.
Dick Einrecker, I'm a minister. Is there anybody here I can pray for?
Yeah, the people in those two cars over there. They're shaking, but they're fine. You can talk to them if you'd like.
What about the car up there and the one with the tarp over it?
The man in the red Ford is deceased.
I'd like to pray for him.
Well, like I said, he's dead.
I know it sounds crazy, but I have to pray for him.
You know, if that's what you want to do, go ahead, but I got to tell you, it's an awful sight. He's dead. It's a real mess under that tarp. There's blood and glass everywhere, and the body's all mangled. Well, I gotta warn you, you do what you want, but you've never seen anybody this bad.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. You just listened to a part of the movie 90 Minutes in Heaven. That's a 2015 Christian drama film directed by Michael Polish. And Sayyid Abdullah, let me ask you this question. You know, in that particular part, which happens around minute 15,
when this priest experiencing the car accident and he's allegedly pronounced dead, there comes another priest, all right, and he feels very sorry for this guy. He didn't know that this guy was a priest, one of his colleagues or something. And then he goes, like, he insists on praying for this dead person and convince the officer at the scene to go into the car, although it was very dangerous or something, and they didn't want him really to go there. But he insisted, and then he does it. And at the end, it happens that, like, his prayer is answered or something like that, all right? Why is it so important to pray for the dead? Well, like in this case, or let me just somehow soften it down to not the dead, but the sick. Does the prayer really apply to other people, and does God really listen to the prayers of other people, like about the sick, for example?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When it comes to prayer, obviously, I'm speaking from an Islamic perspective here. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He is the one, He said, pray to me, right? He says, لَوْلَا دُعَا مَا يَعْبَأُ بِكُمْ رَبِّ لَوْلَا دُعَاكُمْ. Allah would not even consider you. He would not even look at you. He would not even give you a second chance or a second look if it wasn't for your dua. So Allah deliberately, He says, I might twist and turn things around.
Yes.
Just so I can hear you talk to me. Well, that's a way of, you know, the irony of Allah's humor, right? He slaps you on the cheek. He's like, oh, God, why? And like, oh, you're talking to me. This is how He wants it, right? So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for example, when He says, if there's someone sick, pray for it. I can cure, obviously, the cure is in my hand. It's not the tablets, not the surgery. It's me who cures. But I want to hear you pray. I want to hear you talk. I want to hear you supplicate. And this is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants from us. So when a person gets sick, or when a person falls in a car, in a car accident, for example, whatever, our first response, because we feel so hopeless to help such a person, and we know there's nothing that we can do, but in our mind, we know for sure there is only one entity that is able to help such a person, which is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Exactly.
So we automatically turn to Allah in supplication and in dua, and we ask Allah for a cure. So you could almost say it's a human embedded programming that whenever you're in need, or you see someone in need and you feel hopeless to help, you just supplicate to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And I think this is how Allah wants it at the end of the day.
You mean it's something quite inherent in people. Whenever you see somebody like in misery, in trouble, your heart goes out.
That's it.
Right?
That's it. And Allah says, okay, this is time for you to talk to me. I can answer. If I feel that you're sincere in your prayer, you're sincere in your love and compassion towards that person who is sick, I will answer. And you see that happens many times.
The key term, compassion. Thank you very much. Let's take a break and listen to another part of the movie, and we'll be back criticizing this movie in this program, Viewpoint.
He's in bad shape. Emotionally, there's no will to live.
What is there left for us to do?
Pray.
We all have talents. David's was organizing. He was able to rally churches from all over the world to pray for me, simply by faxing them.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. We are talking about or criticizing the movie 90 Minutes in Heaven. Brother Hussein, you know, in that part, well, they are praying together, like in congregation. I just wanted to ask you this. What good does it do? Is it like congregational prayer better than single prayer?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. To answer that question, I'm going to say one thing.
Yes.
Inna Allah yuhibbu al-jama'ah. That basically means that Allah likes, you know, congregations, because you know, with unity there's strength. Allah likes to see His servants united to achieve one goal for one cause. And to elaborate on what Brother Abdullah said, Allah likes to listen to his servants pray to him. So praying as a group really makes that bond even stronger and that sincerity even, you know, stronger, I guess. Allah goes as far as saying that, you know, you even get more merits if you pray jama'ah. So, you know, if you're considering doing something alone, maybe consider doing it together with other people so that you can get more merit.
Yes, exactly. And I remember one of the lessons that I was taking, or the classes of one of my Canadian teachers, who always said that, like,